All right, so this, so mine was going to be the sort of wrapping up, if you like, but it's a very grandiose title. I don't know what I was thinking, but I guess what I really mean is how can we build on the evidence base to make improvements to our teaching? And I don't really have the answers to that, but I just thought I'd give you a few things to maybe think about and take away and think about some more. There aren't any easy answers to this stuff. I'll put up the four key questions again, which are pretty familiar to you by now. People have been really good, all the speakers have been really good about focusing on those, much appreciated. So just in terms of where we've travelled so far today, Ian analysed the big picture issues across Australia terrifically well, I thought, much to think about there. Trina and Kathy reported on their research into the mandated curriculum and the issues that sit behind that. Joanne highlighted her connections with and her accountability to community in her role with Indigenous teaching and education curriculum in particular. Susan addressed the challenge of getting students across conceptual thresholds, and we'll watch that research space very closely for the next steps. And then Sean and Odette, of course, most recently described their what is now an internationalised approach to the issues in medical education. So we've travelled a long way, which is fantastic. So I guess one of the things that's come out of it is that it's pretty clear that most of the activity that's happening in this field is in relation to non-Indigenous students. And a lot of it within that is to do with mandated curriculum. So if you put those two things together, the issues with teaching Indigenous curriculum to non-Indigenous students and the idea that many of those students are in mandated programs without a choice in terms of being there, though, no wonder that there are challenges in a way. So we'll be continuing to work on, all of you, I know we'll be continuing to think about this and many of you to work in this area. So it's sort of a double challenge. But I will come back to the issue of the learning outcomes of Indigenous students as well later in my session. So in this session, I'm not going to make you work very hard at all. That's not fair at this point to do that. But what I want to do is just let you perhaps encounter, just read through some of the things that came up in my own work with the academics working in this field when I did my fellowship work a few years ago. And I basically just put up, first of all, some assessment suggestions that came out of those interviews, which are sort of operating at the subject or unit level. Next, a few suggestions about the sorts of evidence that people were collecting or thinking about more at the level of courses, so going from the subject to the course. And then I want to look at some of the issues to do with how we measure teaching quality at institutional level, so those student surveys that go across institutions. And finally, just to touch on some of the research I've worked on most recently with Susan and also with Ali Radloff, who unfortunately is not here today, about some of the issues at national level. So I'm going to sort of pyramid that way, if you like. A bit ambitious, but a lot of it I'm just going to ask you to sort of have a read and have a think. So hopefully it won't be too onerous at this stage of the day. So the first thing I want to do then is to look at just a few of the assessment examples that did come up in my interviews. As I said at the outset, I didn't probably spend enough time on the assessment issues when I did those interviews, and as I also said at the outset, the evaluator of that project picked up on that. So more work to be done on that, and that's why I wanted those green sheets from you, because then we can beef up that part of the website, which will be great. So I'm just going to let you read through those obviously some of you are already using this. I know that the issue of role play has come up in discussion, so I'll just let you read through them. If they're not clear, please ask me and I can expand on them. Mostly they relate to non-Indigenous students, not all, but mostly. comments or, yes?
Sorry, did you say that on the
website? These are not, yes and no. The teaching exemplars that are up on the website, some of them actually contain reference to some of these things, but what we'll be doing in the next few weeks, say months because I'm slow, is having a section which is specifically labelled as assessment, so these will appear there, plus new resources there. But yes, you can find some of this stuff already on the website and expand it in terms of the person actually describing it.
Any other comments about those? Okay. So just some ideas there. And so
that's the sort of thing that some people are doing at the level of subjects. So the next thing I want to look at with you is the issue of evidence, including subject level, but also more at course level. And here's a comment from one of the interviewees that might resonate with some of you. In fact, this is what a lot of people said. It's like, you know, well, yes, I do this, but these are the outcomes. I think I'm doing okay because my students do this and this. And in the end, they said, look, I know it's just anecdotal, and as I'll show you in a minute, some of it is of that nature, I suppose, but we just don't have time to do it. Of course, there's a whole lot of reasons why it's really important to do it, but, you know, there's nobody sort of waving a stick over you, so it's actually quite hard to carve out that time. Having said that, although they said things like that, when I went back and analysed the interviews again, I actually was able to pull out quite a lot of stuff about what could constitute evidence. Now, whether it's the kind of evidence that would convince the promotions committee is another whole matter, and we might have a bit of a discussion about that, but I'll just give you some of the examples that did come up of the sorts of things that made people feel that their teaching was effective.
The sort of the globalised nature of Indigenous teaching and learning is something that I think more and more of us are thinking about. Certainly, you know, Sean's work implies that. So the one about students coming here on exchange, going back and then feeling better able to work with Indigenous communities, Native American communities, for example, because of the course they did in Australia. I mean, that's quite a powerful thing. And of course, you know, across the Tasman, maybe the same thing may be happening. I don't have an example of it, but I'm sure those things do happen. But it's a powerful thing.
It sure is, yeah. It's really interesting. It's quite interesting when we get international students coming in, particularly from America, who have engaged with their native communities until they've come to a course with us. Then they go home and engage, and it's just hilarious.
And you hear back from them?
Yeah. Squeeze, and then can you supervise my thesis?
Well, yeah, actually, that's another outcome that we could have put up there, yeah. And then the Indigenous students who just, for example, never thought that they could be that, and then found that, in fact, they could and did. And I have another bunch of them. So actually quite a lot of stuff, you know, if you think about it.
The students ending up in court, yeah, well, you know, teacher says, yes, you know, but she probably, knowing that teacher, she probably got me to write an assignment on it, you know. But anyway, so a little tongue-in-cheek. And the last one was actually a serious comment from a teacher in environmental law. For her, the fact that the graduates from her course chose not to go into very lucrative private practice as lawyers, in private practice, but actually chose to go and work, and I think the example she gave was the Murray-Darling Basin, you know, working on issues involving land and environment and so on, where there were Indigenous community issues, which those people wanted to work with for much lower salaries. So for her, that was an important, you know, outcome of her teaching. So actually, I'm just going to stop here for a second and just leave you to think about a couple of those, and maybe just have a chat. I know we've done a lot of chat to the person next to you, so maybe you might want to turn around to talk to someone behind you rather than the person you're sitting with. And just sort of see any of these resonate. I mean, Lisa has been kind enough to say that some of the international example resonated with her. So does any of this resonate with you? How are you doing on these issues? Anything you can add?
Sure.
Raved on too much this morning, we didn't get time to talk about.
Yep.
The dot point four, averaging 4 plus in evaluation from large compulsory subjects. We had a bit of a discussion a few years ago. We got a letter off the dean congratulating us on our end of semester unit evaluation results. You know, they're outstanding and so on. And we thought, oh, that's great. And then someone, another colleague from another university, suggested that if you're getting good results in your end of evaluations, perhaps you're not creating enough dissonance. You're not creating enough of that comfortable learning that's going to create the transformation. I thought it was just an interesting comment. I don't know
you're making
it all to feel good or something,
actually that's a big question, isn't it? The whole issue of, you know, evaluations. I would have thought that that those issues of resistance that we were talking about and the discomfort that you raise and that Susan also raised, of course, it would only be reasonable to expect that at the beginning, but if by the end of your subject, and even more so by the end of a whole course or program, you would expect or hope that your students would have moved through that to those mm-hmm. transformative mm-hmm. Places, which would be your ultimate goal. And if you're doing your evaluation at that point, and you're getting that, that's great. So I think it's
you feel good about that.
You know, a large class with mandated curriculum with some inbuilt issues is actually not to be taken lightly. I think numbers are numbers, and I didn't put there the qualitative stuff, the open-ended comments. That's where you'll know what went right for you. So, but thanks for that. It's actually an important question.
It's a problem when everything's embedded. You're embedded.
It's very difficult to evaluate embedded material. Yeah,
it
is. It is. Yeah, and certainly some of the audit work we did in this institution found there was no correlation between students' perceptions of quality in a subject, of course, a subject, and whether or not there was a large amount of Indigenous content. Hate that word, but so there was no correlation in those sorts of evaluations. It's just not possible. It's how it's done. Among other things. So I will move on, actually, because a couple of other things I want to talk to you about. Now, constructive alignment has been thrown around this room several times today, but what I want to get at here is that many people in education, of course, are familiar with Beekes' work on the idea, and as Michelle rightly points out, lots of people have been doing this anyway without labeling it constructive alignment, but just the idea of aligning your learning outcomes, your teaching, and your material and also your assessment, getting those all in alignment. So what I want to do is add a couple more elements and suggest that we can take this idea of alignment further. And what I would want to add to that, of course, is evaluation, which is what we're talking about today, but also this idea of graduate attributes and where do they fit in that, learning outcomes, teaching and assessment thing. Because graduate attributes are often, dare I say, overlooked by teaching staff, and students don't even know they exist most of the time, that's fair to say. So what do we do about that? So what we're trying to do here at Melbourne is a group called the LOGA group, which is L-O-G-A, Learning Outcomes, is actually to try to get the graduate attributes translated into learning outcomes, which at the very least go first in your unit outline. So, and there's some sort of idea that they will be linked to assessment and that they will be there'll be some sort of accountability. So that's one of the things we're trying to do with the graduate attributes, is sort of get them, if you like, embedded in the actual learning outcomes rather than sitting out on their own. Now, I know that lots of institutions handle graduate attributes quite differently, that there's a lot of diversity in how they're handled and probably in excellent ways, but I'm just saying that that's what we're doing. And the other thing is the evaluation. But the idea of getting the evaluation in there, and this is what we call here the student experience survey, which you've got your core items, you've got your optional items, we'll talk about that in a sec. But the idea is that with our evaluation instrument at the moment, we have 140 optional items that staff can choose in addition to the core items which everybody has to use in their student surveys. Not one of those 140 optional items mentions anything about Indigenous anything. And that's, probably not unusual. I would imagine that's probably the norm. But we've actually got a graduate attribute here which specifies, and I'll show you the wording in a minute. So there's no connection between what's available for you to evaluate your subject with and what the university's policy on graduate attributes is. So what I'm suggesting is it would be really good to make that link there, and I'll just show you what we're doing with that at the moment. So for some time, for quite a few years now, the University of Melbourne has had what we call the Indigenous Graduate Attribute, institution-wide, which is that. And I know my understanding is that not a very large number of Australian universities have such an attribute at institutional level, but a lot of institutions have them quite well developed at faculty level. And I know, for instance, your Faculty of Health Sciences, Heidi at UTS,
done a lot of work on this area, and to good effect, I believe. So that's what our graduate attribute is. But of the, as I'm trying to make the case here, that of the 140 optional items in the student experience survey, which, you know, enables staff to get data about their teaching, which can be used for promotion, among other things, they can't, there's no way in which using that instrument they can assess whether their teaching has been effective in that as perceived by the students. And more Indigenous in any way. So that's the conundrum. So in addition to the LOGA group, there's another group chaired actually by Sean, who was here before, called the, and I invented this acronym, the QUILT group, Quality in Indigenous Learning and Teaching, QUILT, very pleased with that, where we're working on getting, and in fact it's been approved and it will happen. We're suggesting that these two new items should be available, and I'd be really interested in some feedback from you whether you think that will make any difference to anything. But so one of them, as you can see, directly echoes the graduate attribute, so aligned. But this one, much more particularly, is going to, we hope, be really useful for people working in those professional disciplines where students, you know, have perhaps, you know, already gone out on placement and so on, where they've actually begun to have some experience at interacting with Indigenous peoples and communities. So that's what we're trying to do, to get that kind of alignment. I'm really interested in your feedback. Okay. All right, so the only other thing I want to just finalise this session with is this issue of what might be done at national level, and I'm drawing on our paper, Sue, so feel free to chip in. So what I'm... One of the things, and this comes back partly to what Ian was saying about we just don't have enough systematic data collection across Australia in our context. And so one of the ways in which we can get data on educational outcomes is by those big surveys such as the Australasian Student Engagement Survey, known as the Aussie, and as you may know, Lisa, that's the same instrument was used across the Tasman. The First Year Experience Survey that many of you will probably be aware of, and the University Experience Survey. Is that what it's called now? Yeah, University Experience Survey. So these are big, and so tens of thousands of students, you know, responses to them, and within that there are Indigenous students responding. But it's a sort of wasted resource in a way. And what we would suggest on the basis of our research is that those surveys are not asking the right questions for the purposes of people such as yourselves, to find out the evidence that we need to do our job better. So the example that I'm going to choose here is, here are four. They pick up on this block mode, or what Ian was talking about, the away from base programs. We found in our research that there seemed to be what you would almost call a dichotomy between the students enrolling in those block mode away from base programs where they actually spend most of their time back in community, and the mainstream on-campus school leaver type students, and with an issue also of outcomes, so the experience, engagement and the outcomes. So we don't at the moment have any way of identifying those students in those national surveys, because there's no item that says, are you in a block mode program? And what we would suggest would be, if you tick the box which is Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander, then some options could open up, and that ought to be a really important question, because these other issues flow on from that, which is to what extent are those students experienced at university located within or through Indigenous centres, to what extent are they in the Faculty of Education. So it's very hard to work that stuff out, and so it's hard to make conclusions, but we think we have some indications that it's very important to make that primary distinction. The question of who students spend most of their time with is also affected by whether or not they're in those programs. If you're in an Indigenous-specific program, by definition, most of your interactions are with your fellow Indigenous students. So when you tick, a response on the item that says, I had very positive interactions with my fellow students, 5 out of 5, we don't know, for our purposes, whether those interactions were with other Indigenous students or with mainstream students. And these are quite important things to know. So we've got actually very positive data about Indigenous student engagement, generally, very positive, and we've written about that. But what we don't know is which group that applies to more or less.
and we've got, you know, some indicators that we think we know, but we need.
So what we're suggesting is
our surveys, if any of you are, you know, in positions where you can influence this stuff on national, you know, advisory bodies or whatever, these might be some of the questions that we don't have answers for these questions. I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, but my impression is we don't.
So, and I should say too that the answers to some of these questions could be a little controversial, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't ask the questions. You know, I mean, the role of centres, I think Ian mentioned, is, you know, the role of centres is much contested, but without the data about the difference it actually is making for students, it's hard to, you know, be sufficiently robust in those responses. So I'll just leave you with that thought of, you know, even at national level, we don't have this the stuff we need to do our jobs properly, really. That when you get this, there's some of our collaborative research. And I just like this comment about the, you know, we're all in this together.